Work session on House Bill 2050.
Thank you.
The Ivies and Michael Silvaggio, if you want to come forward. Ms. Moore, if you could just give us a brief explanation about the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2050 is here basically as the result of a case where a young child victim was forced to live near the perpetrator of the crime, and I believe we're going to hear a little bit more about that. What House Bill 2050 does, and I'm going to include in it the -2 amendments, which are amendments that I've been working on with some of the stakeholders in this. House Bill 2050 would require a court to order a defendant to live outside of a 3-mile radius of a victim of a crime if that victim requests that condition of the court. One of the things that we have done here is we have added to the initial bill that language, if requested by the victim, because there was some concern that some victims, in fact, would not have those concerns about a defendant living next to them. So we included that language in there. Additionally, we took out of the crimes that are to be considered, or that this can be established as a condition of probation or release, we have removed from that assault in the fourth degree and assault in the third degree. We have provided as well that the victim may request the imposition of the special condition either in person, in writing, or through a representative of the victim, including but not limited to the prosecuting attorney. And finally, for the post-prison supervision and parole conditions, we added a sentence that it was sufficient if at the time of the sentencing in the court, if the victim requested that condition, that would be sufficient to trigger it once the defendant was being released from prison. So those are the -2 amendments. I would note for the record, and one of the concerns that was brought to me that I think is important to note, is that when we have a juvenile defendant, a juvenile offender, a youth offender at that point, these conditions would not apply to a youthful offender, and I know that the juvenile department was concerned about that, and understandably so to a certain extent, because, of course, if it's a schoolyard fight, for example, then that could really disrupt a family. And I, having done some analysis, don't believe that it would apply to a youthful offender unless it was a ballot measure 11 offense where that youthful offender was treated as an adult anyway. And I don't believe the juvenile department is troubled by that set of circumstances. So that is what House Bill 2050 does.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name for the record is Michael Silvaggio. I'm a staff member for State Senator Charlie Ringo across the rotunda. And we are sponsoring this legislation in tandem with Representative Barker and other sponsors. The staff measure summary was fantastic, and we are urging the passage of House Bill 2050, which we have named Chelsea's Law, with the -2 amendments. The purpose of this bill is not aimed at offender punishment. It's drafted in very specific terms towards victim protection, and it does not go beyond what is required to protect the victim. The purpose is that long after the commission of such a crime, children who come into contact with their offender have been shown to be more likely to revert to clinical anxiety, depression, sleeping disorders, anger, and just generally self-destructive coping mechanisms. These characteristics can also manifest simply if the child believes that the offender is living nearby without coming into inadvertent contact. And this remains in effect even if the offender, there's a chance meeting and the offender immediately retreats in accordance with the stipulation that they're not to come into contact with the victim. The fact that a person, that a child has knowledge that this person's in their neighborhood, that this person might be at their supermarket, their post office, can have a chilling effect on a young child's life. And this bill has been drafted specifically to address that issue. And the way it's done is not to impose a restraining order, which can inadvertently be broken and doesn't really help the child's peace of mind at all, but to impose restrictions on where the offender lives so that the community common areas, such as supermarkets, post offices, the areas where people congregate, where the child feels that they might come into contact with their offender, or the houses that they drive past every day, to make sure that those are in separate areas of community. We've drafted this very narrowly to make sure that it does not apply in geographic areas in which it would be completely burdensome to find a residential location outside of the 3-mile radius. Right now, 6 months after the first 6 months of court supervision in these cases, the offender is required to live in the county that they came from. Some counties don't have more than a 3-mile radius of residential areas, and it does not apply to those counties. The bill was drafted expressly to minimize constitutional concerns. This does absolutely not affect offenders who have paid their debt to society. This affects offenders still under some type of court supervision, be that probation, parole, etc. The bill has been compared to an Iowa bill that did not withstand a constitutional challenge a few years ago, but I want to stress that the differences between the Iowa bill and House Bill 2050 are innumerable. The most glaring difference in that the Oregon bill applies on a case-by-case basis. It does not treat a class of offender with too large of a blanket. The House Bill 2050 applies only to the victim's request, and it applies in a very clear manner. We don't cordon off large areas of the state that are not related to the case. This applies specifically in each case to one offender and one victim, and does not go beyond what's necessary to protect the child. Now, I urge that it's passed with the -2 amendments, and I will take any questions you may have.
Any questions? Thank you. Please go ahead.
Okay. Chairman Barker, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Ivey, and I live in Portland. I'm Chelsea's father. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on this matter and to address a very important issue with a critical piece of legislation. When a child is abused physically, sexually, or emotionally, there are three things that are critical to their recovery. They must know that they're believed by their parents, other family members, and trusted adults. They must know that what happened was not their fault and that they are loved. And they must know that they are safe and protected. The first two are well within a parent's control, but the third extends beyond a parent's authority. As parents, we need help in protecting our children from those who choose to abuse and victimize them. For the most part, our laws and courts go a long way in providing this protection, but there is still room to improve. House Bill 2050 is another step in strengthening our laws and in providing that protective barrier between a child and his or her abuser.
Chairman Barker, representatives of the committee, for the record, my name is Amy Ivey, and I am Chelsea's mother. I'm honored to be here today as an advocate and voice not only for my daughter, but for all children who have been sexually abused. My purpose for being here is to share the heart of this bill and why it is so important. Our buttons that we have on today show a picture of our daughter when she was 3, a short time before the abuse began. She was a sweet, vibrant little girl whose smile lit up a room. Until one day when her trust was shattered by a very broken and sick man. The details of Chelsea's traumatic experience are beyond comprehension, but unfortunately are also very common among children who have suffered abuse. While the physical act of the abuse itself was very damaging, the emotional abuse Chelsea suffered left the biggest scar. Abusers often use threats of violence to keep the child silent. For Chelsea, some of these threats were, "If you tell anyone, monsters will come and get you. If you tell anyone, I will break all of your toys and throw them away. And if you tell anyone, your mommy, daddy, and little brother will go up to be with God." The impact of these threats affected every area of Chelsea's life. Most children struggle with fears and nightmares, but for Chelsea, hers were very real. She struggled to eat and lost 3 pounds in a matter of weeks. For the first 6 months, she clung to me like glue and could not be in a room alone. She would panic if we went through the line in the grocery store and the checker was a man. Anyone who slightly resembled her abuser would bring about anxiety attacks. My husband and I poured ourselves into helping restore Chelsea's world to one of peace, calm, and safety. Our family's well-being took precedence over seeking vengeance upon the man who hurt her, and we chose to step out of the legal proceedings and entrust the case to the DA. On October 9, 2002, our world was shattered once again. The man accused of sexually abusing our daughter pleaded guilty under a plea bargain and spent less than 30 days in jail. He then began his 10 years of probation by moving from 20 miles away from our home in Bethany, where we live, to less than 1.2 miles. We were never notified, and he lived there for 5 months before we were even aware of the situation. After finding out his whereabouts from a family member, we contacted the probation officer, who was also unaware of his proximity to our family. He explained that although the perpetrator's choice of residency was inappropriate, the only thing he could do was merely ask him if he was willing to move. We were cautioned against taking matters into our own hands, as we would be impeding the man's legal rights. We were appalled and frustrated, feeling once again as though we were being victimized. The perpetrator was unwilling to move and continued to shop at our grocery store and visit our family's library. Our lives became even more stressful. Every time we left the house, we found ourselves on edge, looking for his car and scanning crowds to make sure the man wasn't in the area. The threats he made were still very alive in our daughter's mind. We became deeply concerned about Chelsea's well-being. How would she respond if she would come face-to-face with him in her own neighborhood, where she had felt safe and protected? We even considered moving, but realized that running away was not the solution. Out of sheer desperation, I sent email after email to anyone and everyone I thought might be able to advise us or assist us. All but one of the responses offered condolences, but no solutions. The idea of Chelsea's bill gave us a renewed sense of hope and purpose in our suffering. This law is about protecting our children. As adults, isn't that what we are supposed to do? When I asked Chelsea about how she felt about this law, she said that she wants to tell all kids who've been abused about the law so that they don't have to be scared and that they can be happy. This bill is important to Chelsea, and it's important to us. I want to boldly ask each one of you to please support this law. Thank you.
I understand that there are concerns regarding the bill. The 3-mile safety zone will make a difference. I encourage you on your drive home tonight to pay attention to the odometer in your car and to see how many grocery stores, Blockbusters, restaurants, and Starbucks you pass by within 3 miles. This radius will reduce the opportunity for chance encounter and will take a critical step in building a sense of safety for children. House Bill 2050 places an appropriate level of burden on convicted abusers. It provides conditions by which the convicted abuser can request to have the 3-mile requirement removed from the terms of probation, and with the new amendment also requires that the victim request the 3-mile radius. It simply makes the convicted abuser accountable for the crime that they committed and further removes chances that a child's recovery could be negatively impacted. Finally, House Bill 2050 should not intentionally reveal a victim's home address to the convicted abuser. It can be held confidentially by the parole officer as a data point when helping to properly place the abuser back into the community at the start of their probation. Also, it is worth noting that an overwhelming and unfortunate majority of child abuse cases are committed by a family member or someone well known by the child, which is also someone who already has knowledge of the victim's whereabouts. Again, we thank you very much for your time, and we ask you to consider how this bill can help protect children in Oregon, children that you know and love. And we encourage you to support House Bill 2050 throughout the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
I do. Representative Chair. I guess, Michael, this could be directed towards you or the Ivies as well. I'm curious, how did you come up with 3 miles?
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, the 3-mile limit was... I actually pored over a map of every single county in the state, identifying residential areas and marking off commercial areas or likely commercial developments. The 3 miles is a compromise between wanting to cast a net that covered as many children as possible while at the same time making sure that we did not eliminate residential housing for too many offenders. We realize that it's a constitutional right to have housing. During your post-prison supervision period, and we did not want to impede on that. I can show you some of the test radiuses we made. These are the last two test radiuses that we just overlaid to make sure that there was sufficient residential development outside of the 3 mile area in every county that it applies to. And it doesn't apply to some counties simply because there's not enough room, but the 3 miles we decided was a good insurance that outside of that zone there would be closer and more convenient commercial and common areas available to the offender and to the victim that were different.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Pat Schreiner and John Hummel.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is John Hummel. I'm an attorney in Bend, and today I'm representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. The Dash 2 amendments are much appreciated by my organization. We think they make the bill much better. And let me begin by saying the concept of this bill is worthy and noble, and we definitely support the concept. We think there are some implementation problems that that can be addressed. We don't think they will kill the bill, nor are we seeking to kill the bill. We're seeking to make the bill better. A few areas that come to mind when looking at the bill. As you heard, a victim's address is confidential, as it should be. So we definitely have the concern, how does the defendant know where the victim is, so the defendant know where he or she can locate. We heard a suggestion that perhaps the probation department or the Department of Corrections could tell the defendant that address. Well, that probably should be explicitly set forth so there's some mechanism so that the defendant doesn't unknowingly live within in the 3 miles, and I think that can be easily addressed. One more fundamental concern is, and here's a scenario that could arise, at the time of a conviction, the victim lives at a certain address, and the probation officer might tell the defendant, you have to live, you know, in this certain neighborhood, which is outside the 3 miles. The defendant might buy a home or rent a house and enter into a one-year lease, and at some point the victim might move, and might move within 3 miles of the defendant. And then the defendant would have to sell his house or violate his lease. And maybe the defendant then sells his house and moves, and maybe 5 years down the road, the victim moves again within the 3 miles. So we definitely have to respect the rights of victims such as Chelsea that we heard about. And it's not an issue with Chelsea. From what I've heard, there's no way that her family would move near the victim. So, but there might be some victim who moves. That's might, definitely, there'll be victims who move during the time. So perhaps we could have the law narrowed to say the defendant can't live within 3 miles of the victim's address at the time of sentencing, and that would address that. And those are our only concerns. The Dash 2 amendments addressed our other concerns. So thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker.
Excuse me, any questions?
Okay.
Yeah. Mr. Hummel, I'm just curious what you think of in all of these, the sort of subsection C exception is that the person, the defendant, demonstrates to the court that imposition of the condition would deprive that person of a residence that would be material, significant, and aiding in the rehabilitation of the person or the success of the probation. I mean, don't you think that given the sort of factual scenario that you've put out that, you know, there's this possibility that the victim is going to move after this defendant has entered into the lease or after this defendant has purchased the home, I mean, don't you think at that point that the court could take that into consideration under that particular exception already in the law.
Thank you, Chair Barker. The court might, and unfortunately, criminal law, my perspective, too often involves a wink-wink between the judge and the parties. You can bet a defense attorney might be arguing, Your Honor, this will impact my client's treatment. It could be, you know, quite disruptive with their sex offender treatment. Well, honestly, if they live 1 mile away, they can still get to their treatment program every day. It's not impacting their every Tuesday and Thursday night treatment program. A judge sympathetic to the fact that the defendant would have to sell their home might issue an order saying it would impact treatment, but it really wouldn't. So you have a judge trying to shoehorn in facts to fit the law when really it doesn't. So respectfully, most times I think a judge would do that, but I think if we explicitly create a subsection, we wouldn't have to do the wink-wink, nod-nod scenario. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, I'm Pat Schreiner with the Marion County Sheriff's Office, Parole and Probation Division, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors and the Sex Offender Supervision Network to kind of express some of our concerns about House Bill 2050. First, let me depart from my written testimony because I was not aware of that. We were not aware of the Dash 2 amendments, which definitely do sound better and do sound more workable. I think probably the overarching theme to each time I've come before this committee is that we work these on a case-by-case basis rather than have a generic law that applies to the whole state. And part of what I'm hearing in the Dash 2 amendments is these are specific victims that are coming forward saying this creates a specific problem for me and my family's living situation in this county, and so it does give community corrections an opportunity to work with those victims. Mr. Hummel raised some of our concerns. What happens if somebody is in compliance with that and then the victim moves? So how do we keep track of the victims? Well, in this case, I think some of what you're saying is the victims would be staying in contact with community corrections. The way the bill was originally drafted, it looked like we were going to need to know where all the victims were and where the offenders were, and if they, when they were moving. We would like to stay involved in the working of this bill because we still have other concerns, and some of those are outlined in my written testimony. One is the geographic exclusion. One of our concerns would be that it seems to give smaller counties a waiver because they would be able to say, well, we're less than 130,000 people. There is already a mandate that people return back, not only on probation but on post-prison supervision, that they return to the county where they're residing when they committed the crime. If somebody, and you know, Polk County and Marion County are good examples of that kind of situation, if Polk County is then saying, well, you need to go to Marion County because you're going to be within 3 miles of your victim, and Marion County denies that transfer, now the person has to reside in Polk County. And Marion County has the legal ability to deny that transfer. If Marion County is complying with this law, we may be moving people around and looking for transitional housing because these folks now do not have their legitimate place to live because they're within 3 miles of a victim. So now another county wants us to move somebody here, but we've used up all our transitional housing, and transitional housing costs the state more money. So there's some logistical issues there that concerns me or concerns us. Where it could harden the transfer process between adjoining counties, and so we need to be involved in working through that. And the second provision, and not knowing the Dash 2 amendment well enough, talked about the and this really bothered me, and I thought this one was one that could really have a negative impact on victims, was that an offender can seek to demonstrate to the court or the parole board that no mental intimidation or pressure was brought to bear in the commission of the crime. you know, a sex offender, an assault offender who's offended against a minor generally always is in a position of power and control, and generally they use what we call cognitive distortions or thinking errors to justify that behavior. At the inception of supervision, those are usually at their highest. They're at their zenith at that time, and part of what supervision and treatment is about is breaking those down and getting them to see how they minimize the feelings of everybody else and thought selfishly of themselves, justified the behavior. It just seems, how would that go about? Would that be something that there'd be hearings before the parole board, for the court, for them to challenge this? It seems like that could almost re-victimize victims. We have some concerns about what that lays out. You also could have, God forbid, a victim who is coached or coerced by a family member to come and testify and say, no, I was not pressured or coerced. That piece concerns us. And the third provision had to do with the consideration of, you know, yes, this is the best place for this person to live. They're living with their family. We are concerned about the fact that they're close to the victim, but if otherwise they're homeless, and we really think this is the best case for rehabilitation, and we can work some exclusions and some things to do to avoid contact, but we can't, but we have to support this living environment. And that is something we already do with the high-risk predatory sex offenders, so we have some experience doing that. We have the ability to do that. The 3 mile exclusion, we had the same question that Representative Olson had. How did we come up with 3 miles? Is there anything about 3 miles that's of significance? And we are talking only about where they live. So what if the offender now works within a mile of this person? What if their route to work or their where they go to treatment or where they shop comes within 3 miles? So there's a lot of other logistical issues raise some concerns, we would like to be involved because we have been involved in dealing with predatory offenders and with sex offenders on exclusion zones and setting up parameters of how they get to work and where they can be and those kind of things, and even setting timelines. All of those things are workload issues. It's more things that parole and probation officers need to track with significant caseloads. So those are issues we all need to take into account as we work this process. Thank you. Any questions?
Questions? I do, Mr. Chair. Pat, questions directed towards you. From your perspective, what do you think the percentage is of the sex offenders that you work with that have, to some degree, used mental intimidation or pressure, with their involvement of a crime?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, 95% to 100%.
Okay. Thank you.
Want to move the dash two?
Make sure we have that.
Anybody else testify on this bill? Close the hearing on House Bill 2050 and the public hearing on House Bill 2050 and move to a work session.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'd move that dash two amendments would be moved to House Bill 2050.
Any objections? So ordered. We're going to go ahead and move this bill today, and there are some concerns that are legitimate that can be worked out as this moves over to the Senate side, but and of all the points that were well made about this, the primary concern is to protect that little girl or little boy out there, and that is overriding. And the thought of some poor little kid running into their sex offender at the neighborhood grocery store, I just can't imagine the terror and hurt that would strike in them. Having said that, call the roll, please.
Are you moving?
I'm sorry, yeah. Moving to full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson.
He's excused.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Okay. And I'll carry that. Thank you. The next bill we're here this morning is House Bill 2892, expands the authority of the Port of Portland police officers. Pat Egan, Chief Klon, and Barbara Jacobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning. For the record, my name is Pat Egan, and I'm here this morning on behalf of the Port of Portland, and in a moment I'll be introducing Chief Klon and Barbara Jacobson. This is a bill that we've had some interest in some time. Barbara will tell you, as in her experience as an assistant legal counsel at the Port of Portland, the time she's had to deal with district attorneys who have feverishly called wanting some clarification on the statutes that are referenced in House Bill 2892 and that we're seeking to clarify this morning with your support. Chief Klon will also tell you just a little bit about the Port of Portland Police Force itself. There are a number of folks, myself I think included up until recently, that weren't quite aware of the force, how many officers serve out there and what their purpose is in protecting the public out there and beyond. A couple of things. You have Chief Klon's written testimony. You also have a letter from Multnomah County DA Mike Schrunk, and also a letter that's as yet unsigned. We have, we think, someplace a faxed copy of Sheriff Giusto's support of this, and I believe you've had conversations, Chair Barker, with him about that. We also have an IGA with the City of Portland on this issue and an ordinance that I think Barbara and Phil both will touch on. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Chief Klon to introduce more about the bill. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Phil Klon. I am the Chief of Police for the Port of Portland Police Department. Just a quick background, I've been in law enforcement for for over 20 years in Oregon. Spent almost 17 years with the Portland School Police and the last 3.5 years with the out of the airport with the Port of Portland. This bill involves some modifications to ORS, primarily two areas, a change to the language that allows the port to appoint peace officers to better represent our scope of duties, and secondly, inclusion of the Port of Portland Police in four different areas that define peace officer, police officer, and enforcement officer in ORS. I'll get to the significance of that in a second, but I'd like to talk a little bit about the Port of Portland Police, what we do and what we are. We have 53 sworn officers. These officers attend the Basic Academy. We're certified through the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, have the same certification as any other law enforcement in the state of Oregon. We also have four non-sworn staff in the department. Our primary responsibility is the law enforcement response to emergency and non-emergency calls for service at the Portland International Airport, the surrounding businesses, and the surrounding roadways as well. We investigate crimes. We do preventative patrol, foot patrol, bike patrol, and vehicle patrol. We provide traffic enforcement, arrest people. We are a full-service law enforcement agency. Some statistics. In 2004, we generated 2,689 police reports. We issued 871 traffic citations and made 736 arrests. In airport policing, we not only do traditional law enforcement, but we have some additional duties. We are the first responders, and we investigate all incidents of suspected security violations at the airport. Anything involving a vehicle out on the airfield, whether it's a plane or another type of vehicle, we will investigate that. In addition, as you know, we have the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA. They also put out security directives, which are requirements to the airports for additional layers of security. A lot of those involve law enforcement as well, and we're in charge of making sure that the airport is in compliance with those security directives. Just a little bit of history. They've had police officers out at the airport back into the 1950s. Back in the 1950s, they did traditional police roles, but they also had some other roles. They were in charge of monitoring and controlling some of the movement out on the airfield. That's a duty that's now done by some civilian employees called airfield supervisors, what they call air operations supervisors. Kind of fast forward to the 1970s, some federal legislation came into being over concerns about hijacking. This had a pretty significant effect on the Port of Portland Police. The airport was required to have armed law enforcement at all the checkpoints. The department doubled in size. And in subsequent years, they added bomb technicians and explosive detection canines as well. But the focus was still on who was getting on airplanes. Let's prevent bad people and bad things from getting on airplanes. And in the subsequent decades, most of the aviation events that you heard about in terms of security were either hijackings or explosives on airplanes. In the aftermath of 9/11, September 11, 2001, it brought another change to the focus of law enforcement at the airport. We were still concerned about people getting on airplanes and things that were being introduced into the terminal building. But there was an increased concern about who's watching the perimeter, who's looking for people who might be doing surveillance, who might be trying to get through the perimeter fence, who might be planning some things on the outside that would be a threat to aviation. We had to focus more of our resources outside, and once again, the department increased by 30% after 9/11. We also had to change our focus a little bit from just kind of a standalone shop at the airport. We needed to broaden our focus. We needed to expand our horizons in terms of working with other police agencies. We worked very closely with the Oregon State Police. We continue to work with the Portland Police Bureau, with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, especially their river patrol, because we have a large river that runs along our north fence line. In addition, we have somebody involved in the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. We have several people involved in intelligence and information sharing initiatives, such as the Anti-Terrorism Advisory Committee and the Border Transportation Monthly Executive Meetings. We also expanded the number of our explosive detection teams to four. These are the only TSA-certified explosive detection canine teams in the region. They are a regional resource. They've gone as far as Redmond, Oregon, in support of other law enforcement agencies. Back to 2892. The first part of this bill addresses language in ORS 778.260. This is the law that allows the Port of Portland to appoint peace officers. And it states that they can appoint peace officers for the enforcement of laws and ordinances. But at the end of that paragraph, there's a little tagline that says, quote, at airports owned, operated, maintained, or controlled by the port. This has been interpreted by some people as a limitation of the scope of our authority as police officers. And this is not a recent problem. This is a problem that extends back at least 15 years. In 1993, the City of Portland and the Port entered into an intergovernment agreement, an IGA, which in part to address this issue. That IGA assigned port police officers as adjunct city police officers. In a sense, they had been deputized as city police officers, in part to overcome the argument that our authority is limited to the airport property. That agreement also had some real important language as far as our mutual aid relationships and basic language. It also gave us the ability to enforce city ordinances as well. The significance of that was in court cases, defense attorneys were raising the language, the limitations that appeared to be in that particular ORS, and saying that if we took enforcement action off of the airport property, for example, we did a traffic stop out on Airport Way or on Marine Drive, or we made an arrest of somebody that was off of airport property but adjacent to the airport, they were arguing that our authority did not extend to that. The IGA addressed that, and our strategy has been over the years, working with the deputy district attorneys who are assigned to cases, to provide them with a copy of the IGA if this issue came up, and they would present it, and generally that was sufficient to overcome any arguments in terms of our authority as police officers. More recently, defense attorneys have tried a different tactic, which is instead of addressing that particular language, introducing the definitions of police officers or enforcement officer as it appears in the vehicle code, and basically asking our officers, where in this definition do you show up? And the truth is, we're not in those definitions. We may be implied on there's a couple of them that make mention of other agencies as assigned by law. We were still able to use the IGA language in most cases to overcome this argument. It was somewhat awkward, but it was effective in most cases. Until we had a case in 2004, we had an officer who was testifying in a traffic case which was off of airport property. The defense attorney brought up this argument that we were not in the definition for an enforcement officer. We had a fairly new officer who had not faced this issue before. We had a deputy DA who was not familiar with the IGA. Essentially, the deputy district attorney kind of had to stop, basically ask for a continuance. I communicated with that deputy DA. I told him about the IGA. I faxed a copy of the IGA to him. It was presented, but this particular judge decided to, in this case, to give the defendant the benefit of the doubt. In debriefing with the person who's our liaison with the district attorney's office, their opinion was that this was not precedent setting. It was a decision that they disagreed with the judge. Still, we were sufficiently concerned about this that we began some discussions about how we might address this legislatively in order to provide a better remedy for this issue.
Right, and that's where we are today.
Right.
So, and just for the record, I have a signed letter from Sheriff Giusto in support. Any questions? Yes.
Yeah, I do have one question. Would this affect in any way any existing or future union or employment agreements?
No, none
whatsoever. Would this change any duties at all? Bring in change definitions?
No, we are actually operating under the authority that we have through our agreement with the City of Portland right now. What this would do, this would not do away with the agreement, because that agreement does have language in terms of mutual aid and our ability to enforce city ordinance. But we would no longer be relying on borrowed authority from the city in order to have statewide authority as a peace officer.
Thank you.
Okay.
And I would add to that, the IGA only covers the tri-county area too, and so there's some argument if you go past a border and you're in a mutual aid situation, then you don't have any authority either under statute or the city ordinance via the IGA. My experience...
If you'd identify yourself, please.
Pardon me?
Would you identify yourself, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name for the record is Barbara Jacobson. I am legal counsel for the Port of Portland, Representative Baker, and committee members. My experience with this has been, and the reason the DA's office has signed a letter in support, is often I'll get a call right in during a recess in a case with, from a panicked DA, what do I do, because the officer doesn't know where to direct them. And in most cases, either I'm available or the chief's available. But if we're not, it's a situation that puts the DA in a very difficult position as well as the court. So, and most, while most of our cases have to do with traffic stops, we also do a lot of policing in the North Portland area around the airport, the perimeter, as the chief mentioned, particularly with the shortage in budgets and reductions in law enforcement officers. There's more and more reliance for us not only to protect the airport property and borders, but just that general vicinity. Mm-hmm. And we do have a lot of situations now with methamphetamine arrests in that area. So certainly where a traffic citation, losing a traffic case is not that bad of a thing to happen, but losing some of these other cases would be much more problematic. Fortunately, that hasn't happened so far.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Move to a work session on 2892.
Mr. Chair, I make a motion to move House Bill 2892 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson, excuse.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
And Representative Olson will carry that. Let's open a session on House Bill 2902, and if I could have Mr. Parker and Mr. O'Reilly.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Kevin O'Reilly. I'm here representing the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America, and we strongly support House Bill 2902. Since the beginning of the first parking program was begun in 1991, and it was begun under the auspice of the State Patrol, the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America were worked with the Oregon State Patrol in setting up the localized parking enforcement programs, helping train volunteers, these sorts of things. We continue to offer training on a local level and help local governments institute other volunteer parking enforcement programs. We believe this bill will help these local communities in having, again, volunteer parking enforcement programs. It'll do things like purchase film. Often they'll take a picture of the offending vehicle. It'll help buy identification vests for the volunteers and communications equipment, and possibly even provide a little bit of mileage for the volunteers. Currently, many volunteers use their own vehicles and at their own expense. Our organization is currently involved with three communities. That would be four communities, I understand. Portland, Gresham, Milwaukee, and Washington County. Our members act as volunteer coordinators and assist these communities with support for the purchase of film, travel expenses, and caps and vests for identifying the volunteers. And it's also my understanding that the PEP programs do a little bit more than just write citations. They've helped in the recovery of at least three stolen vehicles as well as other stolen property. And at that time, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Parker here, who is a lot more familiar with the program than I am.
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, good morning.
With us today also is Mr. Stan Harmon. Stan is a member of the Oregon chapter of the Paralyzed Veterans of America. He's a Korean War Marine Corps veteran, and he is retired from the Portland Police Bureau. He was shot by a bad guy in 1977 and was medically retired at that time. He serves as the Parking Enforcement Program Director for the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America. I want to provide a little bit of background on this program, how it became, and what has happened over the years since 1991. As Mr. O'Reilly stated, in 1991, the Oregon Legislature adopted Oregon Revised Statute 811-632, which essentially authorizes any law enforcement agency to recruit, train, and deputize, if you will, volunteers from the community to enforce those statutes which deal only with parking for disabled persons. At that time, the Oregon State Police stood up and said, we want to be the statewide sponsors of this volunteer program. So they joined with Oregon PBA. We designed a training syllabus. We came up with policies and procedures which would be adopted and used in the program. And we trained and recruited and trained a number of volunteers at that time, and they went to work. It was a very successful program under OSP's oversight, and it expanded tremendously. The program was worked out of field offices in Salem, in Albany, in Eugene, in Springfield, in Grants Pass, in Medford, in Pendleton, virtually around the state. However, we noted at the very beginning that there was going to be some cost involved in this program. The Oregon State Police provided windbreaker jackets and baseball caps as identification apparel, which was necessary because it helps to prevent confrontation with violators. It clearly indicates that violator is authorized by the law enforcement agency to be doing what they're doing. PBA bore the greatest part of that expense by providing cellular phones, paid for the airtime for those phones, and provided Polaroid cameras and Polaroid film. Because every violation, for every citation that was written, a photograph was taken, which would indicate that vehicle was in fact in a parking space reserved for the disabled. In 1994, Oregon PBA severed their relationship with the Oregon State Police with regard to this program, because the state police told us, we're going to start charging volunteers for their windbreakers and for their cats. We just can't afford to provide them. And we went to the superintendent at that time of the Oregon State Police and said, this is not in keeping with the concept of volunteerism that we endorse in the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America. As far as we're concerned, no volunteer should have to pay for any of the equipment that they use in their volunteer efforts. And the state police didn't back down, so we got uninvolved in our support of the OSP program. However, there were other programs in effect around the state by this time which were not under the oversight of the Oregon State Police, and OPVA continued to support them. By the year 2001 or 2, I don't remember which, the Oregon State Police said, we are no longer going to sponsor this program. We can no longer afford it. Even though the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America had sunk about $100,000 into this program of donated money from grants and from individual donors. None of the money from the fines levied during that entire period, none of the funds went back to the Oregon State Police or to any other agency to help support the programs. So when the OSP said we're no longer going to sponsor this program, Oregon PBA, we kind of got our backs up and we decided, okay, we're gonna go full steam ahead. we're going to approach individual agencies and see if they will sponsor the programs. So that's when Stan really went to work. Stan runs all of the programs in the eastern Portland metropolitan area. I oversee the program in Washington County. And Stan's working very hard to get more and more agencies involved. At this time, there are several cities in the state who have picked up the program on their own, either with or without OSP's assistance. We continue to provide some financial support in whatever way we can. For example, we just gave a grant to the Washington County Sheriff's Office for $5,000 to help sponsor their, I believe it's called, the North American Motor Officers Association Conference, which is coming up. And we'll have a tremendous display on the volunteer enforcement program and how other agencies, even out of state, excuse me, can start such a program. We estimate that between 1991 and about 2001, 6,500 citations were issued in this program, raising a projected revenue of $2,275,000, all of which went into the black hole we all know as the general fund, and none of it came back to the programs. With 3% coming back to those agencies, then we would have had approximately $68,000 in financial support to keep those programs up and running. And had we had that, I think some of those programs would still be alive and well today. We're out trying to resuscitate the ones that we had before at this time. While I say that Oregon PBA continues to support these programs, it's becoming more difficult every day with the competition for nonprofit dollars. You can watch TV and see that there's a tremendous competition there, and we're just one very small competitor. So we try to get donations directly for what we call a PEP program, Parking Enforcement Program, and we do get a few. But the 3% would help tremendously, and I think would go far in ensuring the future of this volunteer enforcement program. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
I just wondered what the thoughts were on the distribution of that 3%.
I'm sorry.
I was just wondering what the thoughts were, the plan on how to distribute back to the municipalities, counties, and agencies the 3%.
According to the proposal, 3% would go back to the agency or the jurisdiction which wrote the citation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. Having been down at the Albany office with the state police for the last 5 years before I retired and everything, had the opportunity to work with the enforcement unit down there. And John Gabrielson was a retired CHP officer who lost a leg. He was the coordinator down there. They did an outstanding job down there. And we hung on to them until 2001. So
I believe you presented me with a certificate at one time.
Right.
Thank you.
And I'd just like to mention, of course, I worked with Stan Harmon over the years, and his two brothers worked for one of them, and one of his brothers worked for me in the Portland Police Bureau, and all three of them are former Marines.
They're indeed legends in their own time.
In their own mind, anyway. And I'd also like to point out that Mr. Parker has been the past president of the Paralyzed Veterans of America, the national group. And I just was thinking how time flies. It was before my daughter was born that you were actually one of the true heroes after the Tet Offensive and retaking Way City in the Republic of Vietnam, in South Vietnam. And we really appreciate your service and really appreciate your work on this. This got sidetracked last session just due to the volume of things, and we're glad we could resurrect it. And we looked into another question that come up about the striped lines, if they had to be 60 degrees or 45, and the state assures me that striped lines of any direction will work on that, so we didn't need to. I had a bill drafted, and it was repetitious and unnecessary. So thank you very much again for your service.
My privilege.
Do I have a motion?
You have to gavel the work.
Yes, I have. close the public hearing and open the work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2902 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson excused. Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. And Representative Thatcher, I'll carry that.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I'd be honored if I could take that.
Okay. Well, we can do it from the full committee.
Okay.
Chief
Chair, thanks. What do you want?
Go ahead. Okay.
Got a bidding war.
Yeah. Glory grabber.
It was a cop thing.
Yeah.
I think so.
He wants to make up for OSP pulling its support.
Yeah.
Hey, whoa.
I lost my schedule.
2464 probably.
Okay. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2464. Ms. Moore, can you give us a rundown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2464, as drafted, would create a crime of interfering with the service of document. However, my conversations with the proponents have led me to believe that they are actually going to ask this committee to adopt the Dash 2 amendment, which instead of creating a new crime, would simply provide a defense to the charge of criminal trespass if the person making entry did so for the purpose of making personal service or personal delivery of a legal document in the manner required by law.
Okay, thank you.
I don't see.
Laura Smith, Aaron Crow, and Matt Marquis.
Committee. I'm Laura Smith with Dave Barrows and Associates here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Process Servers. And Council is correct. We are here to talk about the Dash 2 amendments. But before I speak directly to those, I'm going to let Mr. Crow, he is the president of the Oregon Association of Process Servers, talk to you a little bit about why we feel we need this bill.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Process servers in the state of Oregon have a bit of a problem. We've been serving papers as private process servers for about 60 years. The numbers are growing now, and while the overwhelming majority of them are served without any incident whatsoever, most people out there are very reasonable. They understand our judicial process, and in most instances are expecting this, and a very small percentage, but yet a number worthy of this bill. Some defendants are effectively avoiding the commencement of the action, which prejudices the plaintiff, the people who've been, many instances, have been wronged. What happens is, for instance, there are a lot of documents that are not judicial, non-judicial documents such as a trustee's notice of sale. Now, the state of Oregon has made a lot of amendments how that's handled, but one thing that has not changed, a lot of people can now be served by mail, but the one person that needs personal service or requires personal service under the law is an occupant. Now, because it's non-judicial, we can't give it to a sheriff. A lot of sheriffs don't serve non-judicial documents. By not answering the door, what they usually do is call the police. And we don't even know that anybody's home. All of a sudden, the server goes back to their car, starts mapping out the next service, and a police officer arrives, going up to the door, thinking, well, I didn't think anybody was home. Now, this happens a tremendous number of times. It's amazing. The police go up to the door, they see the process server get out of the car, and they'll escort the process server to the curb. While they go up to the door, they knock. Somebody comes to the door, they go in, or they'll just stay at the door. They identify themselves. The door's closed. Sheriff's deputy, a police officer, comes back to the sidewalk and says, well, that's them, but they don't want you here. You're trespassing, and you're now on notice. You can't come back. And this has become quite a situation. Other situations are, they always include trespass. Our issues are trespass. We don't have any rights more than anybody else. Instances involving violence, virtually always occur while the process server is leaving. They're leaving the property. You know, I can go, you know, Bill King hit Manette with a fist as he's walking towards his car. Stephen Black, a laceration in the back of his neck as he's leaving. Darlene Otta, small woman, about 5'2", thrown to the ground as she's leaving. Most of these start with a smile, but as soon as they see the paper, the frustration that surrounds that issue finds expression at that moment. Some people don't have the impulse control to wait until the process server leaves, and they take it out on the process server. It's a serious situation for some of these people, and in every instance, the district attorney has failed. They can't prosecute because of the trespass issue. They don't have a right to be there. Now, 15 states have taken the lead to make resisting service a crime. Initially, this bill sought to do that, and it has been amended to initially give the process server the right to be there. The concept of officer of the court, while it is given to an attorney, is an officer of the court. That is not extended to a process server and is not a defense in these issues. A few weeks ago, just in Marion County, Judge Burton dismissed a case where a defendant pulled a gun right in the face between the eyes of a process server in the open. There were smiles as they were approaching, and it wasn't until he realized what was going on that it involved service of process. He pulled a gun out, told her to get the F off his property, and said he was going to shoot her. And she turned around and ran as quickly as she could back to her car. He said he was going. He yelled out, "I'm going to shoot this gun in 5 seconds." Now, a world-class sprinter couldn't get off the property in 20 seconds, but she was scared to death. And what the judge said is this process server had no more right than anybody else to be there, and she was trespassing. It's a problem. And this is why we support this.
Okay, great. Mr. Markey?
I just wanted to clarify a couple of things, if you wouldn't mind, Mr. Chair. Once again, Laura Smith. Just wanted to talk to the Dash 2s and make sure that everybody realizes at first we did come with a criminal penalty involved. After talking with members, we understood that there was more willingness to go and do a defense for these guys when they are on people's property. I just want to make it clear that not only must they be serving process, but they also have to be in the public areas of a person's property. So it would be on the front porch, on the sidewalk. This doesn't allow them to go into the house or give them anything further beyond just the public areas.
Thank you for that clarification.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Markey representing the Oregon Collectors Association. I'll keep my comments short. We are testifying in support of House Bill 2464. Members of the Oregon Collectors Association tend to be high users of process servers, and unfortunately sometimes people do interfere with the service of process, making it difficult for everybody involved. This bill helps solve that problem, and I would urge your support. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Yes, actually, I do have a question. I just wanted to clarify, you're stating that, thank you, Mr. Chair, you were stating that a lot of violence occurs as people are leaving, or as the process servers are leaving a property, and the DAs could not successfully prosecute the perpetrator of this violence because of the trespass issue. Now, just having a defense or a reason to trespass, are they now going to be able to, press charges or successfully prosecute those violent incidents?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, it is my understanding that now they will be able to go in and prosecute if they can prove that the process server was on their area and serving process, that then they can go ahead, once they prove that, then that they can go ahead and prosecute on assault charges or whatever the other charges may be.
Good. I guess that would be the goal, wouldn't it?
That is our goal.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Hummel. Did you get a chance to see the Dash 2s? Okay.
I did. Chair Barker, members of the committee, John Hummel representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Our concerns have been addressed by the Dash 2 amendment, so we no longer oppose the bill.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay. Any further testimony? We'll close the public hearing. Open the work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2464.
Okay. Any objections? So ordered. Motion on the bill.
All right. I'll move it to the full committee. I'll move House Bill 2464 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson, excused. Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher will carry that one.
Sure, you don't want it? I want this one, actually.
Okay. I'll ask you some questions. I'll ask you some questions.
Where's the last one?
Where? Okay, we'll go ahead and move to open the hearing on House Bill 2142. If you could give us a quick rundown.
Yes, and actually, Mr. Chair, I believe this is a work session. Okay. It was scheduled for work session.
It was scheduled for work session. So we'll open a work session on 2142.
Members of the committee, we first heard... We took testimony on House Bill 2142 on February 3rd. I think it was one of our first meetings as a subcommittee, actually. And what House Bill 2142 was specified circumstances under which correction officers or other officials employed by the Department of Corrections could use deadly physical force. What happened, or what occurred in the interim was the Department of Corrections, having listened to concerns of stakeholders, clarified a few things. First of all, they defined what co-located minimum security facility and standalone minimum security facility means. They then stated that a person housed in a standalone minimum security facility or co-located minimum security facility, those persons would not be subject to the use of deadly physical force. Additionally, inmates assigned to inmate work crews who may be attempted to escape, that it would not be a situation where deadly physical force could be used. And finally, during transport or other supervised activity. So I think what these dash one amendments do is narrow the situations in which deadly physical force could be used after DOC listened to various stakeholders' concerns.
Okay. I lost any witnesses on this, or
just a work session.
Okay.
So unless committee has questions,
I actually have questions for you, Heidi.
Okay.
I'm trying to follow what this is saying at the bottom. Actually, notwithstanding subsection one of the section, a guard or other police or peace officer employed by the DOC may not use deadly physical force in circumstances described in section two, and then parenthesis three. So where are we looking when we are referring to? Are we looking onto the original bill?
Section two? No. We would be looking at the amendment section two, subsection three. So this notwithstanding subsection 2A. So when it says notwithstanding subsection 2A of this section on page 1 of the amendment, then you would actually look to the bill for that subsection 2A. So essentially what this is saying, I mean, you know, the initial bill says that a corrections officer or other official employed by the Department of Corrections is justified in using physical force, including deadly physical force, when and to the extent the officer or official reasonably believes it necessary to prevent the escape of an inmate from a DOC institution, including the grounds of the institution, or from custody, or to maintain or restore order or discipline, et cetera, et cetera. But then you have this sort of exception taking minimum security and inmate work crews out of a deadly physical force situation.
Thank you. That's what I want to know.
Exception. Thank you. Any other?
I have a motion for the move the amendments.
Well, I make a motion to move dash one amendments to House Bill 2142.
Any objections? So ordered.
Make a motion, then, Mr. Chair, that we move House Bill 2142 to the full committee with due pass recommendation.
Okay. Call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson, excuse. Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. I'll carry that one.
Sure.
Okay, next, open a public hearing and work possible work session on House Bill 3025. Mr. DeLashman, et al.
Mr. Chair, I'm here as a supporting cast, and the sponsors of the bill didn't sign up.
So, well, they can come up if you want to bring them up.
For the record, Brian DeLashman, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. I guess I was the first one here, so I signed in, and I didn't feel that there was any need for backup. So, the Oregon Council of Police Associations is interested in this bill. If you go back historically, a number of sessions, and I don't know, the sessions all flow together for me now, but several sessions ago we passed the existing statute, which subsequently has at least a portion of it been stricken down by the courts. But the intent, or the, what we were trying to get at in that situation, was when an officer is involved in a situation in which they give a lawful order for somebody else to that may be a bystander, a partial participant, or a, just happening by, gets involved in a situation that may then compromise the safety of the officer or the situation and escalate a situation. We would like to have the ability for the statute dealing with interfering with the police with a peace officer situation. Just to give you an example, may in fact be an officer engages somebody that they believe is involved in drug activities, but it's just not one person. There's multiple people, but they have reason to believe that the one person in particular is the one that's done the criminal activity. They engage in that conversation, and at some point in that conversation, the other members of, let's say, a gang begin to threaten the security or the safety of the officer themselves, or at least in the officer's belief that these people are starting to approach them. The officer says, back off, I'm talking to this person here, and they refuse that order to back off for the situation, for not only the security officer, but so the situation doesn't escalate into something that no one wants to occur. That's what we were attempting to do historically. The court subsequently did strike down a portion of that, the language, and so we're back this session, along with our colleagues and friends, to try and resurrect the intent of what we were trying to get at without getting into a situation where the court we can't go. It's too vague. So the language you have in front of you is one attempt to do that. There is a parallel bill in the Senate that has had a hearing and had some work on it. And so we're here to answer any questions, and I'm sure that my colleague can fill you in a little bit more.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Daniel Swift. I'm the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. Yes, this bill, I've been working very hard on both this side and the Senate side with Senator Prozanski. There has been some language I have crafted in conjunction with him that is scheduled for, I believe, a work session on Monday coming up. And it's our belief that between the two bills, we are definitely going to be able to work out a resolution which will restore what we feel is important statutory authority for police officers to control emergency situations and scenes that nevertheless will pass constitutional muster. And it's just our hope that this bill would at least be kept open until we can see where the one on the Senate side comes over, and then try to craft language that meets the agreement of both sides, and we can send to the governor's desk, and hopefully we'll pass a constitutional muster as well, while still giving us the authority to do what we need to do when we're out there at the scenes.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions?
I have a question.
Yes.
This had to do with a free speech issue. Is that what the court overturned, their right to express or have free speech?
Mr. Barker, Representative Krieger, I believe that the original court decision was being used. It was a City of Portland case and had to do with authority to peacefully gather and petition the government for a redress of grievances, and the Portland Police Bureau, my understanding, has decided they violated some statute of the interfering, used that as a statute to shut down a march or arrest people who weren't obeying orders of officers, and the court felt that no, the people were there had a right to assemble, and you can't use this statute for that purposes, and that's why they struck down the portion B of the statute. So that's why, in the current version that we're working on, there's a very clearly defined section that it does not apply to constitutionally protected activity.
Mr. Chair, if you'll look at line 16, that is specifically allowed. So it makes it clear that this cannot be used for the purposes that were struck down by the court.
Ms. Maud, did you have any additional information on that?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. The case actually that specifically struck down subsection B of the existing statute came out of Clackamas County, and it was State of Oregon versus Illig Wren. Illig Wren based its decision on State versus Osmus, which was out of Portland and dealt with a disorderly conduct, the disorderly conduct statute. But based on the Supreme Court's analysis of the disorderly conduct statute, the Court of Appeals struck down subsection B of the existing interfering with a police officer statute because it felt that it was overbroad. So what the essential concern was that by the statement refusal to obey a lawful order of a police officer captured too much constitutionally protected activity, therefore the drafting was overbroad, therefore it was unconstitutional. So that's why it got struck.
I wonder if the courts would apply that to themselves in their courtroom.
That's different.
I know.
Do you, I guess my question is, I know, Mr. Chair, that Kevin Campbell from the Chiefs of Police, who couldn't be here today, brought you some suggested amendment language as well. And my question is, should we wait and see how things go on the Senate
That's
side?
That's what I'm going to do. I agree.
That's
okay.
What I'm going to
do. Okay. Okay. So, okay. Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on this. So we'll wait and see what's going on next door. And then
sure.
Get one together.